from the studios of WMFE in Orlando, Florida. This is the Space Exploration Podcast, asking the question, are we there yet? When it comes to human space exploration, we're on the brink of something big. We're going to Mars. Well, not right now, but in the not-so-far-off future. There's a lot of work that's going into sending humans to a completely different world. We have to build new spacecraft, design new spacesuits. We've got to answer the question, can humans live and work in space for the almost 3-year journey? And while they're there, how do you feed them? How do you keep them busy? Are they going to go crazy on the trip? And what can we expect when we get to Mars? What does the surface of the red planet look like? And can we even live out there and work there? Well, in this podcast, we're going to explore the efforts of scientists, administrators, and thinkers that are trying to answer those questions when it comes to this giant leap to Mars. In every episode of this podcast, we'll try to find out how close we are to this ambitious goal, and we'll ask the question, are we there yet? But before we look to space, before we even leave the atmosphere and count down, before we head to Mars, let's start at a place a little more familiar to all of us here on Earth. Hollywood. That's right, we're starting in Hollywood. The movie The Martian follows stranded astronaut Mark Watney, played by Matt Damon. Now, most of the technology that you see in that movie is stuff NASA and other agencies either use or will use for deep space and planetary exploration. So the film's based on a sci-fi book called The Martian by Andy Weir. And right before the film premiered, Andy gave me a call to talk all things Mars. And he began by telling me what got him thinking about the book and the eventual demise of botanist Mark Watney.
Well, I was sitting around at home imagining how a manned mission to Mars could work, not for a book or anything, but just because that's the sort of dork I am. And I was thinking, okay, how do we get people to Mars? How do we get them back? How do we keep them alive when they're there? And any mission plan needs to account for failures. So what if this piece of equipment breaks? What if that breaks? What if these two things fail at the same time? How do we make sure the crew doesn't die? And I started to think, like, hey, these failures and the things you'd have to do to stay alive are starting to make for a pretty interesting story. So I created an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of them.
How much research did you put into the specifics of a mission to Mars and what could fail?
Oh, tons of research. It took me about 3 years to write the book, and I would say I spent half that time researching, but, you know, not all. I didn't do all the research up front. I did it as I needed it. Everything in the book, with a couple of exceptions, everything in the book is real science, and I did all the math and worked everything out as best I could.
Is that the same stuff that NASA uses now or will use in these upcoming Mars missions?
Absolutely. All the technology shown in the book is real. It's not just speculative. Like the ion drives that Hermes has, they have those. Those exist. Those are real and even put to use in space probes already. The oxygenator is, there's an experiment called MOXIE that's going to Mars in the Mars 2020 rover mission that'll be doing that is basically the oxygenator as described in the book, and so on.
Looking at NASA's plan for putting astronauts on the surface of Mars, does it closely resemble what you wrote in the book, or how do they kind of differ?
Well, NASA doesn't have a firm, they haven't decided on what's the best way to get to Mars yet. There are a few kind of competing ideas for how to get there and what the best approach is. My version is based heavily on a concept by Robert Zubrin called Mars Direct, which is the idea of where you basically have you have all the critical stuff on Mars waiting for you when you arrive. I made a bunch of changes actually to Zubrin's approach because he wrote that in the 1980s and there's been a bunch of new technology invented since then, so I updated it. But that's a concept that a lot of people, including NASA, believe would be a good way. I think it won't be that simple. I suspect in real life, the real first manned mission to Mars will be a very large multinational effort, more organizationally similar to the International Space Station than to the Apollo program. I think it'll be great, but I don't think it'll be like we imagine it.
So you're saying they should read your book as a blueprint, right?
I don't think so. I think they know a little bit more about space travel than I do. I think they're fine.
So in the book, Andy Weir, when people on Earth do find out Watney is alive, all eyes are on his survival and rescue to the point where, you know, cable news networks, you write in the book, have a dedicated show. Where did that come from?
Well, it's just human nature. It's just obvious that that would happen. I mean, if you imagine if that were really happening, it would be wall-to-wall news coverage. A lot of a kind of high concept is basically Apollo 13 on steroids, right? I mean, like when the Apollo 13 astronauts were on their way home during that time, it was, I mean, I wasn't alive yet, but I mean, you can see the old file footage. It was the only thing on the news, nonstop, constantly.
Andy Weir, do you think that, you know, these future Mars missions, the public will be as intrigued with or without a disaster? Do you think they're going to follow this even if all systems are go?
Oh, absolutely. I think that first manned mission to Mars will evoke those exciting feelings of exploration that we had back in the 60s. Although this time without an adversarial space race, this time it would be just, you know, like I said, I think it'll be a large international effort. So it'll be a very positive message, if you think about it. Hey, we may have our problems, but we're all going to work together to do this big, awesome thing that'll be remembered forever.
I want to go back to the book again. The marooned astronaut, Mark Watney, he's witty and genius, walks with a bit of, you could say, swag almost. Kind of reminds me of the early Mercury astronauts as portrayed in The Right Stuff. But, you know, his background is far from the test pilot roots of early astronauts. But do you think that future astronauts are going to have that bit of moxie that Watney has?
Oh, I think all astronauts have that moxie. I don't think you can make it through the selection process without having a high degree of self-confidence and but not recklessness. And also in terms of the scientific aspect of his personality, I mean, he's a botanist and mechanical engineer. That's also already the case. The modern astronaut selection, almost all of them are PhDs in something. I mean, the science aspect of being an astronaut is absolutely critical now.
Andy Weir, here's a question from one of my Twitter followers. The character Mark Watney, he's a botanist, and when he realizes he may run out of food, he decides to grow potatoes. Why do you think he chose potatoes, and why are they the best crop for him to grow on Mars?
Right. Well, it turns out potatoes have the highest calorie yield per land area of any crop, by far. So in other words, if you've got a limited amount of space to grow things in, as Mark has to grow things in his habitat, his little pressurized area, because you can't grow anything out on the surface of Mars. It has almost no atmosphere. The temperatures are freezing. It is just not possible. So with his limited space, he needs whatever generates the largest amount of calories per unit land area. And that turns out to be potatoes by far, like by an order of magnitude for some reason. Just the way nature worked out is potatoes crank out calories compared to anything else.
Andy Weir, as NASA and other agencies plan a long-term mission to Mars, are they having discussions like terraforming Mars or possibly establishing greenhouses on the surface to kind of grow food?
Well, absolutely. A great many people are working on those concepts. Now, just to kind of divide that up, terraforming is extremely speculative. We don't have even remotely the technology to make that happen yet. So that's something that's, you know, centuries away, if at all. But talking about having a greenhouse, that's something that people are working on right now. And the problem always comes back to, it takes a lot of area and it takes a lot of space just to grow food to support a human. So if you wanted to have, you know, a permanent occupancy on the moon or Mars or whatever, you say, like, okay, if we want 100 people, we're going to need this enormous amount of land dedicated to crops if we want them to be self-sufficient. How do we do that? Making a pressure vessel that big is very difficult. And so that's a constant challenge. And I think probably my guess is that will eventually be solved by a combination of two things. First off, really good ISRU, which means in-situ resource utilization. So people will be able to make pressure vessels out of stuff that's on the moon or on Mars, so you don't have to bring it with you. That's number one. And then number two, I think GMO crops are going to be critical. People will, you know, the scientific community will say like, oh, okay, well, it took us a long time and a lot of money, but we've figured out a way to make super soy. And it, you know, it produces, you know, in a very small volume, it produces this enormous amount of like soybeans, you know, way more than natural soy would, to compress the amount of space necessary to sustain a human population. That's my guess.
But will it taste good?
Yeah, absolutely, because taste is much easier to control, because you can have imported flavorants, right? So it's like, okay, here's soy mulch, and then here we just need like 1 kilogram of concentrated flavorant, and that'll take care of a family's needs for years, and you know, so it that'll be an element of trade, right? And if you have a colony, you will have trade with that colony, and that's one of the things they'd be really interested in.
So this movie received quite a bit of buzz on social media, and also the New Horizons flyby. That was the deep space probe that snapped the photos of Pluto. That got quite a bit of traction in social media circles. Do you think the interest in space exploration is growing?
Yes, I do, and I think that's reflected in the entertainment industry. You know, because remember, entertainment industry tends to follow current public trends. They'll make movies about whatever they think, you know, people want to see. And we're seeing more and more of the realistic science fiction, or pseudo-realistic, whatever, kind of near-future space exploration stories like Gravity and Interstellar and now The Martian. And I think that, and these are big-budget movies with big talent, big directories, and I think that reflects a growing interest in the public eye about the space program. Plus, which I think just as Americans across the board, we're all a little butthurt that we don't have a manned program and we need the Russians to send us up to ISS. I think that kind of wounds our pride. We've all grown up with the idea of like, well, we're the masters of space. Well, now we're not. And people are like, can we go back to being the masters of space?
I mean, that's an interesting point, you know, where we are. We're paying for rides up there. I mean, do you think that NASA can kind of, you know, let's say, leverage this public opinion to get some more funding? It's funding is always the issue here. Can they use that?
Always funding. Yeah, and absolutely. That's it's clear that they want to do that. They are heavily, like, they're playing up. They're definitely taking advantage of the release of the Martian. They see it as an opportunity to really engage the public in manned space flight again. And they hope that that'll lead to more public interest, and more public interest usually leads to more funding. Or if it doesn't lead to more funding, it would lead to, like, maybe less funding cuts. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Andy Weir. Your book, it was a self-published ebook at first. Pretty hard science fiction in there. There's quite a bit of hard science. Are you surprised at the reaction that this book has gotten, being picked up by a publishing house and now a major motion picture starring, you know, some big names like, you know, Matt Damon? And are you surprised that it took off the way it did?
Yes, absolutely. When I wrote it, I was writing it for this tiny niche audience that I had at the time. I was posting it to my website, and I had about 3,000 regular readers that I'd accumulated very slowly over 10 years. And my writing was always like highly scientific and technical and dorky. And so these readers are highly scientific, technical, dorky people like myself. And so I knew they would be very nitpicky on anything science-related, and I knew that they're the sort of people like me who want you to show your work. And so that's what I did. I wrote The Martian for them. It never occurred to me that it would have any mainstream appeal. I really still don't know what I did right. I mean, if you think about it, the book reads like a series of math problems, but still everybody seems to like it. So I'm really happy about that. I just wish I knew, you know, what I did.
So you could do it again, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
what's kind of the process of translating that to the screen?
Well, so what they did for the film, they didn't want to stop and explain everything and give you numbers. Otherwise, it would be like, it would kind of play like a classroom, you know, informative video, right? Mm-hmm. So what they did was, they are accurate to the science. Everything in the film is accurate, like the book is, but they just don't give you all the numbers or explain all the details. So anybody who cared to go off and do the math on their own would find out that everything's correct, but they don't spend a bunch of time explaining every detail, you see?
What's been the reaction from scientists that are working on this technology? Are they kind of like at awe to see it in a film or in a book or it being utilized in this fictitious world?
I think they're mostly excited to see it being like their research being put into the public eye. You know, like I got to talk to. I recently went to JPL for an event, and one of the guys who came up at my book signing was the guy who's working on Moxie, which is basically the oxygenator from the book. And he was like, he's really excited. He's like, you know, this is that thing in your book. This is exactly what we're working on. And he gave me a copy of his paper on the program. Like they wrote a paper first before actually building the thing. And it's just really neat. It's great. Scientists are very passionate about what they do, but it's rare for the public to be as engaged as they are right now. So I think they're really excited by it.
Andy Weir, do you consider yourself an advocate for space exploration at this point?
Oh, absolutely, and I always have been. That's not going to be a surprise to any of your listeners, I think. I've been a lifelong space nut for both manned and unmanned space flight. And, I think that we should have a long-term goal. When I say we, I mean humanity, should have a long-term goal of making a stable, self-sufficient human population somewhere other than Earth. It could be the moon, it could be Mars, it could just be a big old space station in solar orbit, but something that is not Earth-reliant. It can have trade with Earth, that's awesome, but not Earth-reliant, because once we do that, our odds of extinction go to pretty much zero. But right now, when we're all on one planet, there is a small but non-zero risk that our species could end.
NASA wants to send astronauts to Mars, they say, by 2030. Private space companies say they can do it by 2020. Knowing what you know, when do you think we're going to step foot on Mars?
Well, I think NASA absolutely could send people to Mars by the 2030s if they got to maintain their budget. But I don't have faith in Congress to actually budget it. So I'm guessing more in the 2050 time frame. And like I said, I think it'd be a large international effort. As far as private space flight companies, let's be clear and draw a distinction. There are companies like SpaceX, and then there are organizations like Mars One. Now, SpaceX is a booster company, and they have designs to go to Mars, but their main focus is on being a booster provider, basically a freight company for transporting things into orbit. I think commercial space flight is going to be instrumental in an eventual Mars mission, because by the time we're putting that together, the cheapest way to get stuff into orbit will be these, you know, contracted spaceflight companies like SpaceX. So you'll see something like, okay, NASA and ESA and the Russian Space Agency and a bunch of other guys all get together and they say, we're going to make this happen, but we need to build this ship that's going to weigh like 600,000 kilograms. So we need all that stuff put into orbit. So, okay, hey, SpaceX, we want to buy 19 launches from you to put this crap up into orbit, that sort of thing. So that's how the commercial aspect will come into it. Now, as for Mars One, I don't take them seriously at all. I think they serve a useful purpose as a think tank, but their funding, they have these, in my opinion, ridiculous notions of funding. Right now, they have about $400,000, which is not enough money to colonize Nebraska, let alone Mars. And they think that they can get tens of billions of dollars from a reality TV show. And that's, you know, many, many multiples, many orders of magnitude, like 100 times more money than like all the reality TV shows have ever gotten. So I just don't take them seriously as anything other than a think tank.
Andy Weir, what's next for you? Do you have your next book in mind, and can you share it with our listeners?
Yeah, I'm working on my next book now. It's tentatively titled Zhek, Z-H-E-K. And it's more traditional sci-fi. It's got aliens and faster-than-light travel and stuff like that. I put a lot of work into coming up with a physics model that allows faster-than-light travel and doesn't violate any other physics. But, yeah, it has some made-up physics in it. And I'm most of the way through the first draft now, and I hope to get that out in mid to late 2016.
Andy Weir, he's the author of The Martian. He joins me by phone. Andy, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Sure, thanks, and thanks for having me.
Well, that about does it for this episode. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. You can follow the show online. We're on Twitter at AWTY Mars. or reach out to me in the Twitterverse. I'm at SpaceBrendan. Are We There Yet? Is a production of WMFE. You can follow more space news online at WMFE.org/space. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.